May it please the court, counsel. Good afternoon. My name is Ingrid DeFranco. I represent Darlene Ann Spears, who had a very strange trial. As the court is aware, about a week into the trial, Ms. Spears became very ill. She had apparently begun to be ill on the Monday of that week, and her condition deteriorated throughout the week until Friday morning, when she was brought to court pretty non-responsive and unable to remain in the court. And I apologize, I have a cold, so I have to drink my way through this. At that time, the court made a finding that because she had elected to stop taking medications for some sort of psychotic disorder, we have testimony, or anxiety disorder, there's some indication, and for high blood pressure, that she was responsible for her illness. The defense counsel argued again and again and again that the court had no basis to make such a finding and that any such finding required a medical analysis. He said, I don't know what's making her sick. I know that she wants to be here. She has always wanted to be here. She has done nothing to indicate that she didn't want to be here. I don't believe she's manipulating the system. The court permitted her to be examined over the lunch hour and indicated that if he received medical testimony indicating that her condition was not self-caused, that he would revisit his findings. She was apparently too ill over the lunch hour to permit much of an examination. But what the court did learn before trial resumed on that afternoon was that she had a fever of 102 degrees. The court made then a finding that that fever was caused by her failure to take her medications. And that's the point at which the ruling becomes clearly arbitrary. That is a bizarre ruling.
Well, Mr. Franco, let me ask you a question. Isn't there some indication, or is there any indication, that the defendant had sought medical attention earlier or accepted medical attention earlier, that she might not have gotten as gravely ill as she got?
I think not. We don't know precisely what was wrong with her from the record.
But isn't it a problem that she refused any medical attention whatsoever during, you know, it seems to me it was over a couple of days.
I think that the only evidence in the record is that she refused medical attention from the noon hour till some point in the afternoon or evening when her condition became so grave that she had to be hospitalized. What she refused in the morning was an injection of the psychotropic medications that they were attempting to give her, and that's all. And there was no other medical evaluation offered other than that of a nurse who said her vital signs are fine, I don't find anything wrong with her.
The court didn't find that she had refused to take medication for 7 days?
The court did find that.
So she had been refusing medication for longer than just over that day?
That's correct, but I believe what Judge Terry asked was whether she had refused medical treatment. And I don't believe that there's any indication that medical treatment was offered earlier than noon of that day, or at least medical evaluation. And we do know from the record that the medications were for a high blood pressure and for some sort of an anxiety disorder, or the testimony the court has is that it was for a psychotic disorder. That's what the psych tech came to the court and testified, but there's no indication of that anywhere else in the record. The court's findings in the morning didn't rest on any solid empirical foundation. That's pretty clear. The court was clearly exasperated with Ms. Spears, who was completely non-responsive, as far as we can tell in the courtroom. But the court's findings at 1 o'clock or 1:30 that afternoon became manifestly arbitrary, because there is no reasonable basis for the court to conclude that someone would be running what's considered quite a high fever as a result of not taking blood pressure medication or as the result of anxiety. And that's the point at which the error becomes profound. And then, of course, we know that what happened over the next few hours was that her condition deteriorated tremendously. And then on the next day, which was a Tuesday, there having been a holiday Monday. The court reconvened the trial and explained to the jury that he was going to need to send them home. And everything went well from there on in with regard to that. So we're really only concerned with the piece of the morning where the court made the initial finding that she was willfully unavailable for trial and then refused to revisit that finding when the medical information came in and in fact she was quite ill.
Counsel, let's assume, moving forward from the point that you're on, that it was error, that it was error for the trial court to have not revisited that particular ruling and switched its ruling. Why don't we have a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt case here, given the other evidence in this case?
Because we have no way to assess the effect of her absence both on the jury and on her ability to assist her counsel with the particularly damning evidence that came in that afternoon, which was the only evidence that linked her brother, Matthew Butler, to her, and which the prosecution then used to demonstrate a conspiracy.
Didn't defense counsel ask simply to have the witnesses stricken, the testimony of those two witnesses stricken?
Yes, and it was denied.
So if we were to assess under harmless error, couldn't we strike those witnesses' testimony and consider the rest of the case?
The court could do that if it found a confrontation violation, but that test is only for a confrontation violation.
But are you asking us to do something differently than defense counsel did at the trial court level?
Yes, I am, because her right to be physically present at trial and to have the jury observe her demeanor, particularly when the evidence concerning her brother came in, that right was so fundamental that in the absence of a valid waiver, and that's a knowing and intelligent waiver, that's a profound error.
To have the jury consider her demeanor?
Certainly.
Was that in the briefs? To have the jury consider her demeanor?
That's what the due process analysis.
Oh no, is that what was argued in the briefs, counsel?
No, but it is part of the due process analysis, and it's part of why the Sixth Amendment and the 14th Amendment rights to be present at trial intersect. And there are clearly two rights that are at issue there. Without her being present and the jury being able to know why she wasn't present when that damning evidence came in, we can't assess the effect on the jury. And a finding that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt doesn't rest on anything solid.
Well, Mr. DeFranco, wasn't there other evidence in addition to this evidence that that linked the brother to this crime? For example, the sniffing dogs, et cetera, and the jacket, that sort of stuff.
The dog sniff evidence linked the father, not the brother.
Well, it linked to that apartment, and
correct.
The brother was staying in the apartment.
Correct. But there was the only other links to the brother were extremely thin, one of which was that he, according to the prosecution, left the state of Colorado on the next day and didn't return for the funeral, and that there had been some history of animosity between him and the victim. And that was it. So the inconsistent stories about how he hurt his hand or wrist became pretty compelling, because the prosecution theory that was presented to the jury was that he injured himself in the commission of the crime.
Counsel, before I leave this point about harmless error, and can't we just, if we were to find error, disregard the testimony of these two witnesses, isn't that what the reply brief suggested would be the appropriate test, to just disregard those witnesses and assess the rest of the case?
For a confrontation clause violation.
Isn't that what the reply brief suggested was the appropriate application of the harmless error test in this case?
If the court finds a confrontation clause violation.
Did they suggest a different application of the harmless error test anywhere in the briefs?
No, Your Honor, but I think the brief was quite clear in explaining that the Supreme Court has established the test for a confrontation clause violation and that that is what it is. So if the court finds a confrontation clause violation, that's the appropriate test. With regard to the trial court's ruling on Ms. Spears's refusal to take medication, there the court exacted a price from her by finding that she was willfully absent from trial based on her refusal to take medication. That, we submit, is a forced election between constitutional rights. There's the right to bodily integrity, and the Colorado courts have recognized that a pretrial detainee or a prisoner can't be forcibly medicated except in a very narrow set of circumstances. And if she elected not to accept those medications, then she would be found to be willfully absent from trial. That price was an improper price to pay. If I may reserve the balance of my time.
You may. We have 4 minutes and 6 seconds remaining.
May it please the court, I'm Christine Brady, registration number 24779, representing the people. In regard to the voluntary absence, voluntary waiver issue, my version of the facts are just slightly different, so I'd like to go over some key things there. The defendant was taking Vistaril and high blood pressure medicine 4 months before trial. That's established in the record. Now, Vistaril, it's true that it is an antipsychotic medication. Basically, it means it has a sedative effect. It's used in the state hospital for mentally ill patients if they become dangerous. And here, there's no evidence that the defendant was taking it for any kind of psychosis. As a matter of fact, the jail nurse testified that the defendant was having panic attacks and severe anxiety. The jail nurse did testify that it can be prescribed for mental illness, but there wasn't even a claim below that the defendant had some kind of psychosis. So basically, this medication that she refused was not because she was incompetent or she had any kind of mental illness. She just refused to take it. And I'd like to do the timeline on how this happened. On Friday, January 6th, is when testimony began. It was the first day of testimony for trial. That's when she stopped taking the medication after 4 months. Then on Monday, she got very ill. They blamed it on the pictures of the victim, apparently very gory pictures. She vomited even during the trial, and then later on apparently she passed out in the elevator. We learned that, I believe, from the jail deputy that was escorting her, but the court didn't know all of that at this time. On Wednesday morning, she refused to go to court. She told the jail deputy, no, I don't want to go to court, my stomach hurts. They convinced her to go. She's still not taking her meds. On Thursday, she did fairly fine at the trial. There's no evidence of anything happening on Thursday. That night when she was in the jail, she got sick again. Without being too graphic, she had diarrhea. Okay, it's Friday morning. She woke up and she was very, very ill. At this point, it's a full week when she did not have either her high blood pressure medication or her anxiety medication, the Vistaril. She doesn't show up for court, and defense counsel says to the court, my client is sick because she is not taking her high blood pressure medicine. She has a very bad condition with high blood pressure. At some point that morning, the court was able to convince the defendant, I'm sorry, the jail deputy was able to convince the defendant to take a shot of Vistaril. She'd been taking it in pill form for those 4 months. Now they said, well, you're nauseated, let's give you a shot so you can feel better and you don't have to swallow the pill. She did that, and she shows up at court for a hearing. So they're actually having a hearing to decide if she's too sick to come to court. The trial court, after the hearing, which there wasn't really any evidence presented at the hearing, but the trial court finds that it had been observing the defendant all week and she was competent. She was competent to choose, basically. So he sends her back to the jail to get a medical evaluation and specifically finds, after the medical evaluation, the examination, we'll see what kind of information we have there and I will make a ruling about, are you really voluntarily absent if you're not showing up?
Ms. Brady, when is this occurring?
It's right before the noon break.
On Friday,
within an hour of the noon break. Of course, they've already got the witnesses lined up for that afternoon. These are witnesses from Louisiana, out of town. They have tickets to leave right, you know, that evening. So the court knows that it's under some pressure. It needs some information. It has to decide, are we going to go forward with this testimony or not? So the court, in an effort to get some information here, is this being caused by the defendant or is it something totally different? And throughout this, there's no medical testimony at all by a doctor. All we have is the nurse explaining what's going on with the meds. So there's no medical testimony.
When is the nurse testifying as to the meds? Is that in the afternoon?
That's before the noon hour.
I thought you said there was no evidence presented.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant to say there's no medical evidence from the doctor. There's no medical evidence from the nurse either. The nurse is just saying she had a panic attack and she refused her meds. So that's why the trial court didn't have enough information to decide. So he sends her back to the jail, and there is, contrary to what the defense counsel has said, there is evidence that she refused, not only refused any treatment, but she refused the doctor's examination. And that's the point that I was trying to make. We have no evidence from the doctor. We can only speculate, well, she had fever. That must be an infection. It must not be from the meds. It must not be from the high blood pressure.
Ms. Brady, do you have a cite to the record that indicates that she refused to be seen by the doctor?
Well, I'm sorry, I don't have the cite, but it's in the trial court's finding. The trial court found specifically non-cooperation with jail medical staff in getting treatment or an examination. Now, of course, later that night, she's hospitalized. And
well, let me ask you this. Was there evidence in the afternoon that she had 102 degree temperature?
There is evidence in the record that she had 102 degree temperature.
And was there any explanation as to how 102 degree temperature is caused by the lack of these medications?
No, but there was no testimony whatsoever about what was causing the fever. I'm not a doctor. I don't know if fever can be caused by some kind of problem with high blood pressure, maybe infection of the kidneys. That's all just speculation without anything, any kind of medical testimony on the record. And this is what the trial court found. Now, later on in the afternoon, before the witnesses testified, the defense basically renewed its motion to say, look, you know, we cannot have these police officers testify. And the trial court revisited the issue and said, okay, I made an original finding. Testimony proceeded. And then this new information came up about the blood disorder. Now that's all they will call it, is a blood disorder.
Information came forward the next day.
It was actually Monday, yes, when the defense renewed its motion.
So you heard my question earlier to your counterpart. At that point, if we were to assume for purposes of discussion that the trial court made an error in not revisiting and not reversing its decision, do we have harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? And
Can you elaborate and take into account your counterpart's response to that same question?
Yes. I think that that is what defense counsel said should be done, and I think that this court may do that. You can strike the testimony if you think it was error and look at the other evidence in the case to see if it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And in this case, the evidence against the defendant was overwhelming. Specifically,
on both the murder and the conspiracy?
Yes. On the murder and the conspiracy, because on the murder, because of the blood spatter evidence was overwhelming, that she did lie about that. She said that she was being held in the bedroom by two assailants, when in fact the blood spatter evidence showed overwhelmingly that she was in the room during the bloodletting. And then conspiracy, because it appeared that there was more than one person, because there were three weapons used on the defendant.
Did they have to prove a conspiracy with a particular individual to convict her?
That's a good question. I don't know. But what they sought to prove, and I think what they did prove, was that it was Butler.
And was it harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt with respect to that conclusion? If we detract from the testimony, the testimony of those two officers?
Yes, there was other evidence in regard to Butler. First of all, there were several witnesses that testified that Butler and the victim did not get along. That was initially. Secondly, there was evidence that they found a bloody jacket in the bushes of this apartment complex. And the bloody jacket actually belonged to Butler's father, who also lived in the complex. And then the dog...
How does that show Butler?
Well, the blood on the jacket did belong to the victim.
Mm-hmm.
And the jacket did belong to the father. The father was cleared in the investigation. He was actually babysitting the grandchildren when this occurred. And we know it was the father's jacket because he walked into the manager's office of the complex, and he was wearing, it was a running suit. He was wearing the pants of the running suit to which the jacket matched, and he testified, and he admitted that same logo on the jacket as the pants. And then there was the police dog that tracked a scent from the window of the defendant's apartment to the door of the apartment of the parents, where the father lived. So basically, the conspiracy argument is it's either the father or it's Butler, the junior, and they cleared the father. And then Butler's very strange behavior.
Did the jury have this evidence about the father being babysitting the grandchild?
Yes, it's in the record that the children were at the Butler residence.
It's in the record before the jury.
I believe it is. If there are no further questions, the people would ask that this court affirm.
I do have another question. Is there any indication in the record I don't know how to ask this question. Had the defendant allowed herself to be examined over that noon hour, that the results of that examination could have resulted in a different determination by the trial court to continue on with these witnesses?
No. And the reason for that is the HIPAA, the privacy laws, were not allowed to ask her specifically about her condition. And the trial court even made that finding. The trial court said, sure, we have this new information, it's a blood disorder, but the specifics are not known to the court. That's what the trial court said when it was reconsidering its ruling. The specifics of this blood disorder is not known to the court. The defendant could have waived the medical privilege and presented evidence to support her claim that the refusal of the meds did not cause this, but she did not do it, and...
Well, let me ask you this. Did the court find, or did the parties acknowledge that this blood disorder was, quote, not her fault?
There was no acknowledgement of that, either way.
Did the court find that?
The
not
court,
her fault?
The court did not find that the blood disorder was not her fault. The court didn't find either way. The court found that it did not have enough information in that regard.
Okay, I have a couple more questions.
Okay.
And the questions come back to the court's failure to revisit the issue once it gets this information about the blood disorder. Why wasn't it an abuse of discretion to now go back and look at and say, gee, we got more information, and maybe she didn't voluntarily absent herself from trial?
Why wasn't it an abuse of discretion?
Why wasn't it an abuse of discretion for the court not to revisit its earlier ruling in light of this later information?
Right. Well, the court did revisit. It just decided not to reverse its earlier ruling.
And its basis was?
Was that at that point, it didn't have enough, when it made that ruling, it didn't have enough information. There still was not information regarding the blood disorder because of the privacy. And in regard to that, since it went along with the voluntary absence based on the refusal of the meds for a full week, she was sick all week, not just that afternoon, based on that, it found that, well, it didn't specifically find this, but implicitly it found that she shouldn't get the benefit of this without showing that it wasn't her fault. And I see that my time has expired.
Did you have another question?
Lucky you. No, thank you.
The people request that this court affirm. Thank you.
And counsel, if you need an additional minute, we'll give you that as well, since we gave your counterpart an additional minute.
I think there are a couple of pieces of the record that I may be able to clear up a little bit. The record reflects that the sheriff called the judge Saturday morning, sometime in the hours, the wee small hours of Saturday morning into the early morning. And that's how the judge became aware that Ms. Spears was in the hospital. Her counsel didn't know it until they showed up on Monday. That's the first knowledge, or no, it would have been Tuesday, excuse me, the first knowledge that they had that she was even in the hospital. The record also reflects that the court sent her counsel out to try to contact the hospital to find out what was going on. And that trial counsel reported back that she was not conscious and they couldn't get in to see her. So there wasn't any possibility at that point of even asking her to waive some sort of medical privilege and allow this information to be transmitted to the court. She wasn't conscious, she was in and out. So what the court did at that point was to take it under advisement, wait a little while, and then say, I think we better bring the jury back and prepare them for a pretty long hiatus. So that's what happened there. With regard to what happened in the morning evidentiary hearing about her illness before the noon hour, the court made a finding that she did this to herself. He said it was as if she had drunk poison, effectively. That's not exactly what he said, but as if she had drunk something that made her sick. So the court made that finding before there was ever an opportunity for her to be examined. And then after the lunch hour, when she had not cooperated with the examination according to the trial court, we had no testimony about what happened. There's nothing on the record about what happened except the court's finding. The court then again said, I find that this fever is the result of her not taking her medications, and I decline to revisit my ruling. Then again on the Tuesday morning, after a lot of new information had come in about how seriously ill she was, There was an attempt at that point to gather some information, and it wasn't successful. Nobody could get the information. Nobody knew really what her condition was, other than that she was in intensive care, comatose, and not responsive, and not able to be seen. So when you ask the question about whether the court abused its discretion by not revisiting its ruling, it's our position that the court abused its discretion first when the information about her having a fever came in, and then certainly again when the information that she'd been admitted to intensive care came in.
Well, let's examine that. Is and why was it an abuse of discretion when the evidence of the fever came in? There was no evidence apparently presented to the trial court that fevers can't be produced somehow from a lack of this medication, was there?
But there's no support in the record for a finding like that. That's tremendously far outside the court's area of expertise. There's simply no empirical basis for the court to make a finding that she's making herself have a high fever by not taking a blood pressure medication or some form of antipsychotic.
How about on that Tuesday or perhaps weeks later when they reconvened for trial? Was there evidence or was there a finding or was there a acknowledged position by the parties that whatever had happened to the defendant was not her fault?
I think there was no on the record finding, to be sure. But I think there was such an implicit finding when the parties reconvened after the long weekend and the court reported to defense counsel what he had learned from the sheriff's department over the weekend. But
nothing in the record at that point about not her fault?
No such finding.
No such evidence?
No, there wasn't.
Mr. Franco, getting back to Judge Daly's question for your counterpart, would it be necessary in order to prove conspiracy to commit murder to prove who it was that the defendant conspired with?
Yes.
Why?
Because the way the conspiracy statute is written, there has to be a person that is your co-conspirator. And in order to prove a conspiracy without proving who the conspirator was, that would be any person, and it has to be with another individual. And the statute doesn't permit you to charge or convict of conspiracy based on conspiring with any person. I see that my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The